You know how every now and then you hear a sermon that just sticks with you? Of course, I know that probably happens to you all every week. But I'm not as good at remembering as the rest of you. Most sermons, when I hear them, they work on me for a day or two, maybe a week if it was exceptional. But every now and then, there is a sermon that sticks in your heart and in your mind for a long time. And that sermon, it keeps working on your sacred imagination. That's how my mentor, Bert Burleson's sermon on the golden calf has been for me. And so I have to come clean with you all today and tell you that this is one of those sermons where I'm really channeling somebody else's words. Because more than a decade later, his words about the story are still sort of echoing around in my mind. And in part, it's because he pointed out what a strange story this is. I mean, this whole journey to Mount Sinai is pretty odd, don't you think? God makes a whole lot of strange decisions out there in the wilderness. Here Moses is, he's pulling out of Egypt with a nation on tow, and they are beside themselves with joy. They're just ecstatic, and they're heading out across the desert with these visions of milk and honey dancing in their heads, and they are ready to go. They're ready to make a beeline for the promised land. But God does something really strange here. Or at least I think it's strange. Rather than going straight to the promised land, God has them take this little detour to this mountain out in the middle of nowhere. And it seems like a pretty bad strategy to me. I mean, here you have this incredibly vulnerable people who aren't used to governing themselves. They have no idea how to hold law and order together. They're just sort of this ragtag bunch of slaves that could easily slip into chaos. So it seems to me that the best strategy would be to get them safe as quickly as possible. You know, you'd want to get them settled in their new home and get their economy going, draft a constitution. Above all, keep the morale really high for the people, excited about this new adventure. But instead, God takes them out into this desolate place where there's no running water, there's nothing to eat, and they're vulnerable to all kinds of things. I mean, the desert is a really dangerous place. It's dangerous physically. It's also dangerous spiritually. In fact, the desert fathers and mothers will tell us that it's the place where all of those hidden demons within you start to show themselves and attack you. So I wouldn't have made this move. But assuming God knows best, there must be a good reason for going to the mountain. And maybe it's to remind us that the journey is just as important as the destination. And in order to actually enter the promised land, there's going to be need to be some maturing on our part. Apparently, we need some time in the desert to be made ready to enter the promised land. Because you see, what is wonderful and beautiful and eternal takes some getting ready for. I mean, you can't just show up at the symphony and really get it having only listened to Justin Bieber your whole life. It's not going to work. You can't get the richness of a Hopkins poem if you've only been fed a diet of the Family Guy and South Park. It just doesn't work. You can't waltz into the promised land and expect to fully enjoy the richness of the sweet milk and honey if you haven't made a good journey to get there. And so Yahweh calls them deeper into the wilderness to this desolate mountain. And it's not a very welcoming place. You know, if I were Yahweh and they showed up to my mountain, I would have done things a little bit differently. I would have thrown them this really big welcome back to me party. And after, you know, just living through all those years of slavery and the trauma of the plagues, I'd want to get them really comfortable. Great to see you all. Make yourselves at home. My mountain is your mountain. Is there anything I can get you? Some milk and cookies, maybe a plate full of power. How about a warm cup of self-esteem? Or you know, maybe we just need a big old divine hug. Come here. I sure hate the way Pharaoh treated you. So if you need anything, you just let me know. I'm your God. That's not what God does, though, is it? Not even close. I mean, they get there, and this mountain is dark, and it's foreboding. There's fire, and there's smoke, and it's shaking and rumbling, and God's presence scares the bejeebers out of the people. And when they get there, God says to Moses, tell them not to touch my mountain. And if they touch my mountain, they're dead meat. And so Moses, he's a smart guy. He gets out the orange construction fencing and he starts putting it around their mountain and he puts up signs, sacred personnel only, beware of Yahweh. I mean, this is not what I would have done, but this is what God does right here at the very beginning. God keeps a mysterious distance and is quite clear with them, I am not easily handled. Don't think you can simply grab a hold of me. I am great mystery. It's interesting, isn't it? But before they get faith, literally carved into a stone, they get a great big dose of mystery. Which might be just telling us that in order to make a healthy journey, we need a big dose of mystery too. We need to see that there is something beyond us. And any gods that are easily handled for our use and our agendas are not a God that's big enough to get us there. Which means that sooner or later, we're going to have to learn to bow in reverence before the one who is beyond us. Well, the people, they get to this holy mountain and they're terrified of the whole thing. But at least they have Moses to intervene on their behalf, right? He's this nice little buffer for them, so they don't have to deal directly with Yahweh. That's a bit scary. They might not be able to see Yahweh or to handle Yahweh, but at least they had Moses. And Moses is God's go-to guy. And so, you know, Moses at least can set them at ease and tell them what to do. At least they have Moses. Or they did, anyway, until the story we heard earlier. And again, it's a real bad strategy here, but basically God just pulls out the pacifier from the people, you know, the way us parents do from time to time. Eventually the time comes when you have to pull away, you give up that security object for your kids, and so you try to hide that pacifier, hoping they won't find it. You're hoping your little one will learn to soothe themselves and not rely on that object of security anymore. Well, Moses had been their pacifier. He was their intermediary, their security blanket, this conduit of God's guidance and power and presence. And God just takes him away up there on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Doesn't seem like a very good strategy here. I mean, if I were Yahweh, I would have given Moses those 10 commandments and sent him back down the mountain, lickety-split, before those crowds get restless. But not God. God keeps him up there 40 days and 40 nights. And here's the really interesting thing. If you read through that portion of scripture where Moses is up on the mountain, it goes on and on as God is dictating to Moses some really mundane things. So for 7 chapters, God goes on and on with details about this and that, about how big to make the tabernacle and where to put the lampstand and what the priests should wear right down to their linen ephod undies. And I just imagine, you know, Moses is up there and he's getting kind of antsy. He's thinking, couldn't Joshua be taking notes on this? So he starts, you know, jiggling his keys in his pockets the way some of you do out in the narthex when you're ready to go and your family's still talking. Moses, he's up there. He's looking back over his shoulders. Okay, lampstand, got it. Ephod, check. Anything else before I get back, Yahweh? I mean, he's getting pretty nervous, I think, because he knows that leaving them down there, it's like leaving a bunch of 7th grade boys alone in a cabin at camp. Nothing good is going to come out of that. Like I said, if I were Yahweh, I would have made sure Moses got back down the mountain right away, but not God. No, on and on God goes, almost as if God is intentionally keeping Moses from them. 40 days and 40 nights. So here's the basic outline of the story so far. God brings them out into the wilderness to this desolate place. God scares the living daylights out of them. And then God withdraws Moses from them, takes away their connection. And that story is the paradigm for our relationship with God. This is the way that God works in our lives. And the saints have said, that it's because this is how real faith is grown. God's presence is always a back and forth kind of thing. There's dramatic presence and then absence. Great power and then great vulnerability. The consolations and withdrawing of the consolations. Have you noticed that in your journey with God, how quickly the feelings can fade? How something once so very meaningful can later start to appear quite mundane. Well, the spiritual fathers and mothers tell us that this is the way that deep faith is developed in us. This is how we get to the promised land. So God does give us these gifts, these feelings and security and meaning, things that we need. God gives us relationships, and God gives us community, and God gives us callings. God gives us these gifts of goodness, people in our lives that we need, people like Moses from time to time. But then in time, like a parent pulling the pacifier, it's all taken away. Ignatius calls it the desolations, the withdrawing of consolation. And it's an important part of our spiritual journey because here's the thing. God needs our hunger and our longing to take us deeper. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, Jesus said. Remember? Our hunger, our longing is a gift. We need the finite, concrete, definable things in our lives to fail us along the way. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but just think about it for a second. I mean, if your marriage was deeply fulfilling all the time, would you ever learn to pray? Or if your job, if your career was completely satisfying for you, would you ever be driven to explore the spiritual path? Would you ever really seek divine presence if mystery itself could just be printed on a bookmark and sold to you at Amazon? We need more. Pop faith needs to fail you because it won't be enough to prepare you for the feast of milk and honey that's waiting. But you know, we don't really believe that. And so we cling to our pacifiers. God knows this. And so with God withdraws those things that have been our channel to God. Moses stays gone, and it's time for the Hebrew people to go deeper, to wait, to learn faith, to learn how to wait and trust. But they don't, of course. They get anxious, and they can't stand that anxiety, that not knowing. They think something must have gone terribly wrong. Moses, he's been missing for weeks now, and that anxiety starts to get higher. And they have to have something to deal with all that sacred anxiety. They need a divine fix. And so they fashion a god from their own hands. Because they need something to take away all that anxiety. They got to get things formed up again. Got to get the feelings back. Got to get all their sacred ducks in a row. You see, when God seems absent, we are really at the threshold of something really good or something really bad. And the only difference is what you do with that absence. Can you wait in it? Can you bear it? Well, they couldn't. They are still slaves. Slaves to their anxiety, slaves to their dependence, and so they make this idol. And notice that they make an idol from the very gold that God had told them to take out of Egypt. That's really interesting. Because this idol, again, it's constructed out of something God had actually given to them. Something God had blessed for them to have. That's almost always how our idols are formed. It's good things that suddenly get elevated to the best things. Some gift that's glorified. Well, they take that gold that was entrusted to them and they fashion it into an image of their own making. And that image of the calf, I mean, that's right out of their own spiritual past. This is old-time religion from their days in Egypt because, well, they're sort of comfortable with that god of the golden calf. They like this god. Everyone really does, the golden calf. It's a pretty popular one as gods go. It's a god they can see and they can define, a god they can manipulate. Of course, our idol making, it's a whole lot more sophisticated. Our idols are a whole lot harder to spot, but you know, just like these lovers of the golden calf, they're almost always made from the gifts that God has given us. And it's so very subtle, all sorts of gifts that end up getting mistaken for the giver. Anything, you know, really can be idolized. An experience, a type of worship, the Bible, the doctrines we believe, yes, even our ideas can become our idols, our conceptions, or our deep convictions, or even our righteous causes. Anything can be idolized. And I'll guarantee you've got some golden calves in your life. There's a chance that some idol has been shaped up from some gift that God has given you, and you know, maybe you're still very enamored with that gift that God gave you, or maybe it's starting to disappoint you now, because you know, eventually they all will, and you start to feel a bit anxious about it, or jealous, or frustrated because that thing is not saving you anymore like the way that you want it to, because of course it can't, right? I mean, that thing was never meant to. And your life, not only your life, but your God up on the mountain is trying to make that quite clear to you. And I know that's painful for us. To have those idols exposed, to get the pacifier taken away. But God does this in love because it's what must happen for you to make the journey to the promised land. You see, you and I, we are being called out of slavery. We are invited into this place of milk and honey to a deeper, richer life. But we're not there yet. We're called to be free and out of bondage, but there is a journey to get there. And that journey, it involves some detours into some hard, dry, and scary places. And it's going to involve dealing with a divine presence that cannot be controlled or handled, and a God that's going to make no bones about what is best for you. It's going to involve some waiting, and it's going to involve trusting in a mystery that is revealed only on its own terms. We don't want it this way. I know that. It's certainly not the way I would have planned the journey. But that's the way it is. And it's the only way home. Amen.